This is HPR episode 2638 entitled Dirt Cheap Magic and is part of the series Tabletop Gaming. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 40 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is Magic the Gathering for cheapskates.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hey everyone, this is Klaatu, and you're listening to Hacker Public Radio. Today I'm going to do an entry in my gaming series about a little game called Magic the Gathering. Now, I've fairly recently gotten into Magic the Gathering to the point where I could actually play it the way that it was meant to be played. In school, long, long ago, I played Magic the Gathering with other, you know, with friends over lunch hour and stuff, but I don't get the feeling that any of us really understood how the game was actually supposed to work, and we pretty much just played by the numbers and kind of ignored a lot of the text, and yeah, we didn't necessarily do it very well, but it was fun, and the artwork was always cool, and there was always a sense of discovery, because we knew that it was a more complex game than we understood, and we were okay with that. We were okay with it being more complex. It's actually very similar in a way to Dungeons and Dragons and how I started with that. You know, where you sort of start out knowing that you're not doing it right, but being totally okay with that fact and just kind of settling into just having fun being in that world. And it's kind of interesting because Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons converged at some point. So back when I knew them, they were separate companies. And then Wizards of the Coast, the creator and proprietor of Magic the Gathering, purchased the company that was the creator and proprietor of Dungeons and Dragons. And so they both exist within the same halls now. And in fact, they're converging even more pretty soon. I don't know when this episode's going to air versus when the book is going to be released, but very soon there will be a book out from Wizards of the Coast so that you can play Dungeons and Dragons in a city, in a setting that exists in the Magic the Gathering universe. So they are very much starting to converge in lots of different ways, and that's kind of cool to know. And in fact, if you go to dmsguild.com or drivethruRPG.com, you can download a bunch of Magic the Gathering settings adapted for Dungeons and Dragons. It's the Plane Shift series, and most of them are free. The culmination of all that work, I guess, is the Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica, which is to be published fairly soon. So, but you can get the free ones as well from online sources. So that's cool. It's all very interesting, and probably really has nothing to do with the topic of this episode. But I wanted to mention that these games are you know, they share a little bit of history, share a little bit of culture back and forth. A lot of the people designing one are talking to the people who designed the other, and so on. But really, the thing that I want to observe is the fact that back when I remember Magic the Gathering, when I was introduced to it, and I was playing at it. I wasn't really playing Magic, but when I was, you know, when I had friends with lots of cards, and I would borrow cards to sort of play against friends, it was very much sort of the feeling that you had this deck of cards, and that was your deck, and that was the game. You know, the game was, I guess, in a way, self-contained. You know, there wasn't really any kind of feeling that, well, you have to keep up with all the latest releases, and you can only play with cards that are 3 years or younger and that sort of thing. And that, to me, when I started getting into Magic the Gathering in earnest, recently, fairly recently, I was a little bit surprised to find that that was very much the culture of Magic the Gathering now. A big part of the Magic the Gathering culture is Friday night magic, and you go to your local gaming store or your hobby shop or whatever, and you can play magic against other people, and you can do these what are called drafts, where you pay a certain amount of money and they open up cards. You open up a pack of cards and you sort of look through them and find the good ones that you or the good one that you want, and then you pass the deck the pack to the next person, and they pick out the one that they want, and it goes around the table, and it's just sort of this. There's a scene to it, and I have no problem with that. You want to pay $20 every Friday to go play Magic? I think that's perfectly respectable. People pay $20 every Friday to go see movies, so why not play Magic instead? You know, that sort of thing. That's not a big deal to me. But at the same time, it's not something that I want to get involved in, because I don't pay $20 every Friday to see movies or to play Magic, and I like it that way. So I wanted the Magic the Gathering experience without the modern-day Magic the Gathering... I don't want to say culture, because the culture is fine, but the overhead of modern Magic the Gathering. And I kind of started investigating how that could be done. And it was a little bit discouraging at first, because I did find that it's really built into the game that if you want to play Magic, then you have to, you know, when you're building your deck of cards that you will take into a game, you have to sort of make sure that it's legal, quote unquote, for that format, meaning that there are different kinds of Magic the Gathering games. So if you're playing, I don't know, whatever the normal, I think it's modern, then that means that you can only have cards that are, I don't know what it is, I forget, but let's say 3 years or more recent. And then if you're just playing, I don't know, something else, Commander, then you can maybe use cards that are, you know, only go back so far, and so on. So it's an ever evolving game. They continually release a new, not continually, but they periodically and regularly release a new set of Magic cards, sort of phases of cards, and they have themes and backstories, and it's all very immersive, and it's a lot of fun, I'm sure, if you get into it. But what I was really interested in was more of the, you know, junior high school experience of, hey, here's a deck of cards. Here's maybe a couple of different decks of cards. You can build a deck to take into a game, and then you can play the game, and then you can rearrange the deck and play the game again, and then you can rearrange the deck and play the game again, and that's it. And there's no need to refer to any master website of a card list to make sure that these cards are fully legal for this format and so on. Now it sounds like a money grab, and I'm sure that it is, and that's fine. I mean, it's a gaming company that wants to fund the continued existence of the game, so that's all good. But the byproduct of that is that as they continue to release new cards, of course, the more they release cards, the more conflict in rules become possible with older cards. So Magic the Gathering, if you don't know, it's a battle card game. So you have cards with really, really fun art on them, really just gorgeous fantasy art. That's what attracted me to the game initially. But each card has a chunk of text on it that does something out of the normal function of cards. So, for instance, a card that you might have in your hand, here's one, a card that you have in your hand, the Aerial Guide, is a creature card. It's a drake, so it's sort of like a dragon. And it has two attack power and two block power. So if you attack with it, it will deal 2 points of damage to whatever it is to whatever player it is attacking, or to whatever creature that decides to try to block its attack. And if it is in turn attacked, then it can block 2 points of damage. So that's pretty straightforward. If you really, if you're trying to understand magic, I mean that's pretty basic, right? You've got numbers at the bottom right of each card, and they control the attack and the block. So here's the Sylvan Ranger, 1/1. So she attacks with 1 and she blocks with 1. Here's the Shorekeeper, 0/3. He attacks with 0, or it really, it's a trilobite. It attacks with 0, but it blocks with 3. So, you know, not completely worthless, and so on. However, there are very often there's text on the card that adds something to just that straight number versus number interaction that you might imagine the game would then be reduced to. So here's the Drake again, this aerial guide. Turns out that it's got two, as I said, but it's also flying. So whenever aerial guide attacks, another target attacking the creature gains flying until end of turn. So that's completely different and possibly meaningless to you. What do I care if this card is quote-unquote flying? What does that mean? Well, that's the sort of thing my friends and I would have thrown out back before the internet was there for every question that we ever could have about Magic the Gathering. But nowadays, yeah, the internet does exist, and you can do research on this stuff if you really want to. And it turns out that flying in a Magic card means that it's harder to hit for other creatures. Creatures have to be able to specifically hit a flying creature. Now, the additional text, whenever aerial guide attacks, another target attacking creature, that's confusing. What is a target attacking creature? Does that mean something that's attacking me? No, it actually means, well, it means any creature that is currently attacking. I can point to it, and it gains flying until the end of the turn. So this aerial guide has the ability to grant some other creature, some other card, the flying bonus. So that's the sort of thing on each card. Every single card has, well, not every single card, several cards. Most cards have some kind of, oh, by the way, or, you know, sort of except, some kind of exception on every single card. Meaning that if the company, as they do, continues to develop new cards, I mean, they've got literally something like over 15,000 Magic the Gathering cards in existence today. So they keep developing cards, and at some point, two cards are going to completely contradict each other or somehow accidentally riff off of each other such that there's some kind of, you know, ridiculous, endless loop of who knows what. So to constrain that, to rein that in a little bit, most sort of public, you don't know who you're going to play Magic with today, most public gatherings of Magic the Gathering, they enforce some kind of limit on how old you can reach into your closet and dig out those Magic the Gathering cards and bring to the table. Because they just assume that if you bring something from, I don't know, 1998, and you're playing Magic the Gathering, you know, cards from the 90s or the early 2000s, there might be a card in there that will have unexpected results when it encounters some other card from a more modern deck. So that's the fear. That's the problem that they're trying to solve by limiting what you're allowed to play with. And that's fine, as I say. That's the company's ability to continue to develop this game and to sort of keep the interest going and so on. Totally get it. But that's not how I want to play. So I started looking into ways that I might be able to create a closed loop. And I was advised against it. People online, I asked a couple of different people and they said, nah, you can't do it, it's not possible, or it's not advised, or you can try it, but you'll probably fall out of it and end up going to Friday Night Magic anyway, that sort of thing. And I just decided to go ahead and try it anyway. I have a couple of friends locally who are playing Magic, but are shockingly, you know, reasonable about it. They aren't really involved in the every single week, let's go get the latest deck of cards or booster packs or whatever they're called. And so that was kind of my target. I knew that I had a pretty solid outlet for Magic the Gathering if I could just sort of build an environment in which a fairly static set of cards exist. And that's the constraint, right? It's just kind of like, well, here's my big box of cards. We can all build decks out of these and then play the game. And it will be more or less a sane kind of rule set. So that's what I set out to do. Not very surprisingly, I found fairly quickly that someone else had already thought of this. That this was a thing already. And as I say, there are lots of sort of agreements that people make when they sit down at a table with each other with a deck of magic cards. There's a bunch of sort of things that they declare. One of those, the main thing is what format, quote-unquote, are we playing? And that defines what set of cards you are allowed to bring into this game. So if you're playing a modern format, the modern format or the commander format or whatever, then you can only bring in cards, you know, within a certain set of cards. As I've said, I'm not interested in that. So there's another one called Pauper, P-A-U-P-E-R, as in poor person. A Pauper deck, or a Pauper format, is one that declares you are permitted to bring in any card from any time, as long as it is marked common. And I think, if memory serves, the sort of adjusted value, the monetary value of the card by whatever organization could possibly rate the value of Magic the Gathering cards, whatever market value, I think has to be under, I don't know, let's say 25 cents. It might be even lower than that. It might be like 1 cent. I'm not sure. And even that, so even Pauper for me was a little bit too rigid. So I just decided I was just going to create my own format, and I don't have a fancy name for it, but it's basically the Pauper format. It is basically finding cards that are mostly common and mostly dirt cheap. And the very scientific way that I set out to do this was I went to my local, one of the many local gaming stores here in Wellington, New Zealand, Cerberus Games, and it turns out that after, you know, a month or 2 months or 3 months of Magic Nights, Friday Night Magics sessions, they put out all the cards that all the serious fans of Magic literally don't want. So these are the discards of Magic the Gathering. They are cards that are valued at so little that people would rather leave them on the table of the game night than take them home with them. That's how worthless these cards are. And so they put these out, and they sell a box of, it must be, let's say, I don't know, let's call it 300. 300 cards for $5. So whatever that averages out to. I'm not very good at the quick maths. $60 a card? I must have done that backwards. 5 divided by 300? Ah, there we go. So about one cent, possibly 2 if you're rounding up, per card. That's pretty good. It's pretty spot on. Now, there are a couple of things that you have to sort of think about if you go this dirt cheap route. And if you don't have a gaming store around that sells discards, which I don't know how common this is. This could be something that all gaming stores do. It might be something that they do sort of if you ask. It might be something that they don't do. But you can find collections of Magic cards online as well. So you can get a big stash of Magic cards, or at garage sales, you know. Lots of times people, you know, the kid goes off to college and the parents find the big box of tradable playing cards, and they just think, you know what, I'm sure they don't want that anymore. We'll just sell it for a couple of bucks at the garage sale. So if you keep your eyes out, you can find them. And if nothing else, you can get them online. And there are marketplaces for Magic the Gathering cards. So you can go and pay your 1 or 2 or 13 cents per card and end up with quite a good, shall we say, collection of cards for very little amount of money, especially if you're comparing it to what it would cost to actually get involved in the Magic the Gathering scene, which we don't want to do. Well, which I don't want to do. I don't know what you want to do. I don't want to do that. So the problem here, well, there are two problems. One is that usually this doesn't include land cards. Land cards in Magic, and this purpose of this episode isn't to explain Magic to you, so I'm going to gloss over a lot of things, but land cards in Magic are basically, it's your fuel. It is the thing that gives you the magical power to cast different cards. So as part of the deck that you bring to a game, you need some number of land cards, and we'll talk about how many we're talking, what we're looking at in a moment, but you need some number of land cards, and typically land cards are not cards that people would ever discard, because they purchase them in land decks, and just big decks of land cards, basic land cards, and that's something that they're going to use no matter what. So in other words, basic land cards are pretty timeless. You'll never see a basic land card that you cannot bring to a game ever. Like, you can bring a basic land from 20 years ago and it's fine. And I don't know if it's actually 20 years, but anyway, when you buy these super cheap poor man decks, you will not generally find basic land cards. Now, what you might be able to find are, I don't know what they're called, fancy lands, advanced lands, whatever, land cards that are not basic land cards. Now, that means that they are over complex. They're called land cards, but then they have a bunch of text in the box, and a lot of times it will be confusing to you, and it will probably have a lot of stuff that's maybe over specific, maybe to cards that you don't necessarily have because you didn't get the pack that land, that fancy land would apply to, or something like that, or whatever. Maybe it's just more than you want to think about as a beginning player. So. And certainly no one would probably populate a deck with zero basic land cards. So what you can do, if you find those sort of non-basic land cards, you can just grab a bunch of those and then declare in your game, ignore the text, these are all basic lands, let's not worry about it. Now, there's another problem there, and that is that there are five different kinds of lands, basic lands. And so if you are piecemealing a deck for as cheap as you possibly can from different sources, you may not gather all, you know, the right sort of number, the right color of lands. So what I do in my games, and this is super novice, and you know, probably disqualifies me from lots of people as sort of a serious Magic the Gathering player, and because I'm not, but I essentially declare that all land is equal. So if there's a card that requires a green land and a blue land, then in the games that I play with my friends today, and probably historically, I don't really remember, but we would whatever land, it doesn't matter. There's no color of land. You just put a land down, and if you're using it, you turn it sideways a little bit so that it looks, so that people know that you're using it, and it's whatever. So there's basically all land is colorless, or all land is all colors, however you want to look at it. So we bottom that out, and that's maybe not, you know, that removes a mechanic from the game that does simplify the game and sort of makes it not exactly correct, but that's fine. It can be fine if you're fine with it. The other trick that I've seen done, and I've done before, is to just grab cards that you are not using as normal cards in your deck, and flip them over. Now, the problem with that is that when you're drawing from a deck and the next card is face up, you know that, okay, that's a land card. So then in other words, you're using, your land becomes your any given Magic card turned over. So it's the back of the card. But again, the problem there is that, you know, then you've got, you can see the thing, you know that your next card is land. So I kind of stopped doing that. The third and final trick that I thought of to do this is to use a deck, and we'll get into this in a moment, because this is actually the point of this episode. But, well, it's one of the points of the episode, but yeah. So you build a deck, let's say, and it has blue cards and green cards in it. It's a blue-green deck, whatever, maybe. So then you can just take a couple of, let's say, black cards or red cards, you know, anything that is not declared as part of your deck, insert those, and then those all become land cards. So you know that, well, I'm playing a blue and a green deck, and I've said I'm playing a green, blue and green deck. That's what I've assembled here. I've just drawn a red card. Oh, that's right, because that's a land card. And then, again, so that it's not confusing, I just put those cards down backside up. Because otherwise, what we've found, me and my friends, is that we'll play, you know, if you've got a bunch of cards on the table, and then you've got a bunch of cards down at the bottom that, even though they're all red and clearly not meant to be fighters in your battle, they're clearly stand-in for land cards. It's information overload. So we just put them face down, and those are the generic lands. Works fine. And that's the cheapest possible option for playing Magic the Gathering. That is the way to get into it. Buy a bunch of dirt cheap cards, find something to stand in for land cards, whether it's just other dirt cheap land, other dirt cheap cards, or just an amalgamation of various non-basic land cards, doesn't matter. And you'll have a big old set of cards that you and your friends can then delve into to build decks in a basically a closed loop system and play Magic, because all the rules work. I mean, there may be exceptions. There might be one or two things where you realize this is such a specific card to what this particular release cycle had in mind that it really doesn't make any sense. And you might have to throw that out. Big deal. What's that, 13 cents at the most that you've just tossed aside? Doesn't matter. So, generally speaking, you will find that your game is pretty solid. If there is text on any given card that you do not understand, you can later look it up online. In the game, ignore it. Play it by the numbers. It doesn't matter that much. That's the best way I have found to sort of learn and to kind of muddle your way through the game without getting completely overwhelmed. Because it is absurdly, some might even say obscenely overwhelming at times. It is they have symbols that they use to represent specific things. They've got different colors, and you might not have all those different colors. They've got lingo that they throw around that you may not know what that means. And there, it's just. And then if you look at, if you watch a video online of how, here's one. Look, flash, flying. What do either of those things mean? I don't know what those mean. So you don't have to. You just look over those things. But yeah, you can look at videos online trying to tell you how to play this game, and it goes on for, you know, 45 minutes, and by the end of it, you've forgotten what they said in the opening. So it's really just it's kind of muddling your way through at a casual pace, kind of ignoring what you don't understand. And again, that's how we used to play anyway, I feel, you know, in a closed loop set, because we were kids and couldn't afford even, I mean, I don't even know if it was a thing back then, but even if it was a thing to keep getting updated sets, we wouldn't have been able to do that. So it didn't matter to us. And anything we didn't understand, we just ignored, looked at the numbers, and that worked for us. Okay, so the problem aside from, well, I don't understand the lingo, and aside from, well, I don't have any cards. Well, you've solved the card problem. The lingo, I've just told you how to defeat. Just ignore it if you don't understand it. Look it up later, and don't worry about it. The final problem is, well, you keep saying all you have to do is get cards and then build a deck. What does it mean to build a deck? Glad you asked, because that's actually what this episode is about. I did a little bit of research into building decks, and there are a lot of opinions online, believe it or not, on the internet. And you can find lots of different sort of methods and lots of different advice on how to build a deck, and then quickly you start getting into really scary territory where people are talking about, well, what kind of deck do you want to build? Do you want to build an aggro deck or a pacing deck or a tempo deck or a control deck? Mind-blowing and jargony and not very helpful. So the best way that I have discovered, and this is not mine, this is by someone online who posted a really great blog post on the subject over on rpggeek.com/thread532036. How-build-deck-magic-gathering. It's by Eric Jome, J-O-M-E. And it's a brilliant little article that kind of goes through the math of what you really need to do in order to come out with a sensible deck. I've tried this several times, and it has worked, I will say, almost every time. And I say almost every time because there was a problem with one of the decks, but I'm not convinced it was a problem with the deck, and it might have been a problem with the way that the person shuffled the deck, i.e. didn't shuffle it enough. So the theory is this, that, well, a standard Magic deck, when you take it into a game, is 60 cards. So the way that needs to break down, according to this guy's theory, is that you need 24 creature cards. And you'll know a creature card because they are very clearly labeled in the middle of the card as a creature. So you need 24 creature cards, and then 12 other cards, meaning, for instance, sorcery cards, or instant cards, or enchantment cards, those sorts of things. And that breaks down further. So every card that you put down on the battlefield, on the table, in Magic, costs some amount of land. Remember I told you that land in Magic the Gathering controls, gives you the a source of magic. That it's your resource, it's your fuel. So every card costs some amount of land. And in order to build a deck that is sensible, you need to somehow strike a mysterious balance between cards that are very powerful but cost a lot of land to play versus cards that aren't so powerful but are cheap. How do you do that? Well, Eric Jome has broken it down for you. He says that a sensible Magic the Gathering deck should include, and I'll put this in the show notes, two creatures and then two others. So, again, instant cards or sorcery cards or enchantment cards. Two creatures and then two others that cost one land. Four creatures and two others that cost two land. Five creatures and three others that cost three lands. Six creatures and two others that cost four lands. Four creatures and two others that cost five. Three creatures and one other that cost six. And that is, if you count it all up, that's 24 creatures of varying costs and 12 others at varying costs. And then the rest, so that's what, 24 plus 12 is 36. So the rest of your deck, 24 more cards, need to be land cards. And that's really tricky too, because in Magic, if you're drawing cards and you're not coming across land cards, you literally can't do anything. There's nothing that you can play without land. So you need to have a pretty good source of fuel. You need the resources of land on a pretty steady basis. And it's a trick. It's tricky to get there, especially if this is your first time building a Magic the Gathering deck. You have no idea how much land to put in. How much? I don't know. 50 land and 10 creatures? 40, 20? I don't know. Well, it turns out it's 24 land, 24 creatures, 12 others. And that will give you a deck that is sane. I mean, it's at least, and remember, you do have to shuffle these things to make sure that land gets evenly distributed through your deck, ideally. But in the end, you'll have a deck with things that'll be in your hand that you can play pretty much from the beginning, because you've got one or two land on the table maybe. So yeah, you can cast this or play that. And then as you accumulate more land, you'll be able to play the more powerful cards and so on. He further advises that your decks be two color, and the significance of the color of the card is sort of thematic, but in terms of what kind of power the card has. So if it's a green deck, for instance, I think it's supposed to be about big creatures and kind of life fulfillment, you know, sort of life-giving, sort of positive energy, as it were. If it's black, it's necromantic, and it usually means that you as the player might take damage in order to further your goal of damaging others, and so on. So the fact that there are different colors does control in some ways what kind of game you will experience, because yeah, I mean, if you're someone who loves to trample over your opponent, then maybe a green and, I don't know, blue deck might be what you want to play. But if you're someone who is a little bit more, I don't know, roguish, maybe a black and green deck might be interesting for you. Whatever, you know, you can kind of style your powers, really, your the weaponry that you have according to the colors within your deck. Eric Jones' article recommends a two-color deck, assuming that, especially for new users, as I'm assuming, that more than that would be a little bit overwhelming, because then there's ratios that you have to figure out. Well, okay, it's a three-color deck, so how many of each color of land should I have? That sort of thing. Now, again, in most of the games that I'm playing, I have collapsed color into not being a factor in terms of the land. So if you're playing a black and a green deck, all your land is both black and green, so it doesn't even matter anymore. And that simplifies that ratio. And I recommend that. I do. I recommend that if you're starting out with Magic, because it's just, in terms of self-designing a deck that is both satisfying to you as a player and just functional within the game, that can be complex. And when you anything you can do to simplify you having to figure that out early on is probably a better idea. Now, I should mention probably that another option to all of my convoluted backflipping is to go to your game store and purchase a pre-assembled deck and live your life with that deck. That is your deck. You can play it against your friends, and everything's good. You're done. It's all the ratios are figured out for you. It's a complete deck. It is a game. And as long as you have other friends with a deck within that series, then you're safe. You can play against each other from here until eternity, and the game will not break. It will be a self-sustaining closed loop game. Easy, done. I just found it more fun to dig through the trash, assemble a deck from the discarded pile, and try to figure out how to make a fun game out of that. Turns out it's not that hard. Magic the Gathering is a really fun game. If you like rules, if you like crunch, you'd love this thing. Again, I spent $5 on it, and I've gotten a lot of play out of it. So the poor way is a fun way, but if you can spend like 20 or 30 or 40 bucks, you can just go and buy a pre-made deck too. It's kind of the simpler way. Either avenue, whichever one you take, it's a lot of fun. I'm recommending it, and I'll put the post to the deck building tips in here, because whether or not you go my way or the official way, understanding the math behind a proper Magic the Gathering deck is pretty interesting. It's actually a really good article that sort of explains itself quite well. And you can argue against the points, and I'm sure a lot of people do, but I found it to be a really good article, so I'll post that in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This is Hacker Public Radio. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Heka Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.